Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM HD1 Evanston, Chicago. I'm Naya Reyes, and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, Northwestern dining workers continue to speak out during a historic year for labor on campus. Spoonfest serves up the best of Evanston and Chicago, Unity's 2025 fashion show, how the internet changed fanfic forever, and the B-List. These stories and more coming up from Northwestern University. This is WNUR News at 6. While their strike still remains on pause, Northwestern dining workers took to the arch this Friday amidst their almost year-long contract negotiation process with Compass Group. Sophia Quesa has the story.
Of silence, Northwestern dining workers returned to the arch on Friday, holding a protest and speak out against Compass Group, Northwestern's dining service provider.
In March, Compass food service workers at Northwestern made history when they walked out on a 12-day strike, a first for the campus. The strike was paused for spring break and in hopes that we would return to the bargaining table with Compass to be able to settle a fair contract. Instead, Compass retaliated against strikers and has been bargaining in bad faith.
That's Patrick Griffin, the organizing director of Unite Here Local 1, the union representing the workers.
Today we're here to tell Compass Northwestern to stop breaking the law and to settle a fair contract.
On May 1st, Local 1 filed federal labor charges with the National Labor Relations Board against Compass Group, alleging repudiation slash modification of contract, refusal to bargain slash bad faith bargaining, discipline and coercive statements against the workers in the ongoing contract negotiation process. Noel Saval is one of the workers who has seen such action at play. They work at Nona Joe's in the athletic dining hall and allege that Compass's communications to workers have taken on intimidating undertones.
I remember one of them saying, like, it is your right to cross the picket line. We're not going to punish anyone who decides not to go on strike. And a lot of it was just, like, very much pressuring leaders in the union to fold before we get everything that we're looking to get with the contract.
Some workers also allege some internal bullying and tension from non-striking co-workers since the initial strike in March. For many, it's frustrating to see Compass seemingly skirt labor law in their negotiations. Here's Melissa Watkins, a barista at Kresge Cafe, who has been working at Northwestern for the past 12 and a half years.
As citizens, as people, we are not to break the law. We are to uphold the law. So I'm asking, as well as my fellow workers, that Compass would do the same, to uphold the law, to uphold our rights as workers.
While it can be a long and difficult situation to be in, the workers are encouraged to stay strong. One community member in their corner is Evanston Mayor Daniel Biss, who was present at Friday's speakout.
Right now, it can feel hard to stand up. It's easy to feel targeted when you stand up against a powerful interest like Compass. You can feel vulnerable and alone, especially when there's allegations of retaliatory layoffs. And it is important for all of us to stand with those workers.
Friday's events are just a part of what has been a truly historic and critical year for labor on campus. It has been nearly a year since Local 1 and Compass began negotiating on May 28, 2024, and workers have been almost 9 months without a contract. All of this contributed to their 12-day strike in March. From these events, the question arises, what have the takeaways been from this year for labor on campus? First of all, as trying as times have been, they've also yielded more connection and community.
I would say, with those of us who were out here on strike, our bonds have never been stronger.
And due to higher visibility moments like the pickets, the campus culture around labor rights has also seen some changes.
When you walk around, you see the I Heart Campus Workers pins. I think we did an incredible job distributing them. We distributed them, I think, around like 2,500 or something like that during the strike last quarter.
That's Julian Pfeffer, Weinberg Senior and a member of Students Organizing for Labor Rights, also known as SOLAR, which works to support campus workers. According to Pfeffer, following March's strike, Solar saw a roughly 75% increase in membership and roughly 1,200 people on the organization's email and communication list.
I think that's a small step. I think, like, students can get more involved, and I would ask them to come join the picket and to get involved, to fill out interest forms, and talk with people in Solar to join the fight.
Since March's strike, Solar organized a string of events in honor of May Day, also known as International Workers' Day, which included teach-ins and food sales. The organization also raised $2,304 in mutual aid for workers through their May Day fundraising drive. For Pfeffer, this work is a way to give back some of the gratitude he has for campus workers.
I feel incredibly thankful that the workers have allowed me and other students to join in their fight. I always say this, I've learned infinitely more organizing alongside the workers than I have in a lot of my classes, and that's not saying that the classes here are bad, they're incredible, but the workers are insanely inspiring. I've learned so much about what it means to show up for one another, more than anything, what it means to demand your rights with joy.
While the strike officially went on pause March 22nd, many workers look back proudly on the time spent on the picket line. Here's Victorina Rivera, who has been working in Elder Dining Hall for 4 years.
Lo que estuvimos aquí la última vez, para mí fue bonito, porque nos juntamos todos, y hay voz.
The last day that I was of the strike was actually so beautiful because there were so many of us. We came together from all over and we were raising our voices together.
As of now, no further action has been taken on the charges outside of their filing, and the workers' strike remains on pause. The future of labor on campus is still up in the air, but the crowds at the Arch hold out hope for a fair contract and remain committed to continuing their fight however they can. Here's Watkins again.
This strike means a lot to me because I'm fighting and standing up for poverty, for dignity, for respect, for those who feel hopeless in a world that's hopeless and broken. I'm fighting to stand up for those who are scared to fight, for those who feel their voice does not matter. Our voices, they do matter. We matter. We matter. These jobs, these positions, they don't feel themselves. It's us.
Compass responded to WNUR News' request for comment with the following. Quote, "We have and continue to engage in fair, respectful, and lawful negotiations with Unite Here Local 1 in full compliance with the National Labor Relations Act. Compass remains genuinely eager to reach an agreement that supports our talented employees and is fair to all. We are committed to resolving the remaining items swiftly and in good faith, with the goal of delivering meaningful wage increases and enhanced benefits that further recognize the valuable contributions of our team." End quote. For WNUR News, I'm Sophia Kesa.
A favorite event returns to campus. The 8th annual Spoon Fest returned to campus, bringing amazing food from the Evanston and Chicago area. Sophia Kesa has the story.
On May 9th, hundreds of students flocked to Art Circle to enjoy crepes, froyo, BBQ, beignets, and other culinary delights, all thanks to the 8th annual Spoon Fest. The food festival held in celebration of the publication of Northwestern's food magazine, Spoon's Spring Issue.
It basically is just a day full of bringing together Evanston and Chicago local food vendors.
That's Medill Junior Laura Weissman, one of the co-heads of this year's Spoon Fest.
So that they can, you know, have exposure in front of Northwestern students, be able to sell their food, and Northwestern students will be able to hear about and, like, educate themselves on what vendors are in and around the area. And it's just a good way to celebrate food and do what we at Spoon do every week and bring it to the wider Northwestern community.
It's the appreciation and celebration of food that is shared among Spoon staff. Here's Medill sophomore David Sutton.
I mean, I feel like everyone likes to eat, but, like, I feel like I've always had a good relationship with food. I've always liked trying new restaurants and trying new places. And, you know, I felt like Spoon made sense to me since I was also a journalism major.
Now, Sutton serves as the event's other co-head alongside Weissman. The two have been working tirelessly for months to ensure the success of one of the campus's favorite events. But it's a tall order.
We see, like, 400 to 600 students come to Spoon Fest, and we have 9 vendors and 6 more student boards. Like, it's not exactly an easy undertaking.
That's putting it mildly. The two have to navigate contracts, permits, and the very crucial recruitment of vendors.
We compile a large list of vendors that we would maybe like to see at Spoonfest, sort of trying to encompass a wide variety of cuisines and like different styles of food. I think we're especially lucky because we've done it for so many years at this point that like we have a lot of returnees and people are like willing to collaborate with us because they know that every year it's like a pretty big hit among students.
Well, four of the vendors are said returnees. Five of this year's vendors are new to Spoonfest. However, Spoonfest doesn't just recruit people outside the campus community. There are also a fair share of student organizations present as well. Northwestern Cooking Club Cookology was one of six student organizations present. McCormick sophomore Alex Sangster helps plan the cooking events for Cookology. Last year, she attended Spoonfest as a participant, but has gained a newfound appreciation on the other side of the table.
Now coming as a club, I also think it's great just to get more people to try our food and come to our events, which I think is really good for exposure, and I hope people like what we have made.
Among her organization's offerings were Basque cheesecake squares and fudgy brownies, but arguably the biggest star of the show were the brown butter toffee chocolate chip cookies.
We also brought these last year, and they sold out in the first hour, so we tripled the amount that we made.
This reporter can confirm that they were indeed out of this world. And while the festival is a lot of work, Weissman and Son find Spoonfest provides the campus with a greater appreciation and excitement for the vibrant Evanston and Chicago food scene. Here's Weissman again.
The students don't really regularly get to experience a lot of those restaurants. So I'm excited that they're coming to not only be able to do that collaboration, but also just for Northwestern students to be able to enjoy their food.
And for Son, once Friday rolled around, the months of work all became worth it.
Honestly, I feel like that's kind of where all the magic comes from when you're there with all the vendors and all the students and all the student orgs and just see everyone sort of having fun, eating food, like talking with each other. I think that's just the coolest experience.
Spoonfest was held Friday from 11 to 4 p.m. If you missed the fabulous food this year, feel free to check out the list of vendors on Spoon's Instagram and do yourself a favor and make the trip. For WNUR News, I'm Sophia Quesa.
From mythology to the runway, Northwestern's Unity Fashion Show has turned campus legends into high fashion statements. Darasimi Bancali has the story.
At Northwestern, fashion isn't just about clothes. It's a canvas for storytelling, community, and creativity. Each spring, Unity, a student-run fashion organization, puts on a runway show with a new theme. This year's myth. But not just the Greek gods kind.
We picked the theme as like a group, and we kind of did this one because we didn't want something that was too limiting, just because a lot of designers that we like recruit don't necessarily make clothes for the theme.
That's Weinberg senior Jada Hill, Unity modeling director and also designer who had her own pieces in the show.
So myth could be like Greek mythology, it could be cultural myths, myth as in like, you know, rumors, things like that. It's really up to any interpretation.
That open-ended theme made space for designers to get bold and for models like School of Communication freshman Vonnie Bonsall to step into more than just a look.
I've always loved performing and just like being in front of people, trying to like showcase a part of your like personality. Like keeping that straight face is also very fun because it makes you feel like empowered in a certain way, like wearing those clothes. And I think it's really nice to bring like a designer's creations in front of people.
Empowerment took many forms, from sleek silhouettes to clothes made of majority plastic bags. Bonsall modeled one of these pieces made of plastic bags.
It was made exactly with like 309 plastic bags because that's the like amount of plastic bags that are used in Chicago every minute. And just being able to like tell that story through clothing and also like feel trusted in by the designer to like tell that story to other people is just a very like delightful experience.
That kind of innovation speaks to Unity's recent focus on sustainability, a thread running through the last few shows. Anna Rose Jones, a Weinberg senior, and Unity's marketing director for the past 2 years, says sustainability has been central to the group's recent themes.
The past few years, our theme has been kind of circled around sustainability and reusability.
From first-time designers to experienced seniors, Unity members build skills and confidence every year.
Being able to see people who had literally zero experience with sewing when they came into this club, be able to design and sew and create just like an amazing piece of clothing and fashion and like art. That's super cool to me every year.
And while models and designers are the most visible faces, Unity made sure those behind the scenes had their moment too.
It was amazing how like the show is like curated to like let those people behind the scenes also have their own moment, because what they do is like super valuable too.
It's also a show with purpose. Every year, Unity donates its ticket proceeds to charity. This year's recipient is Snow City Arts, an organization that brings creativity to children in hospitals.
All of the proceeds that come from ticket sales and everything like that go directly to a charity organization that we choose every year. This year, it was Snow City Arts, which is an organization that works with children who are in hospitals, and it really helps them get their creative juices flowing and becomes a creative outlet for them. And we really resonated with that mission, so being able to highlight that charity organization as well is really important to us.
That impact didn't go unnoticed by the crowd. Weinberg freshman N.A. Witiyata Won Wong was in the audience and left feeling inspired.
Unity is stunning. There's like endless possibility. You can just see that students have so much capabilities and they just do like more than you expect.
From myths to materials, Unity's show this year wasn't just a runway. It was a runway of possibilities. For WNUR News, I'm Darcy Bancole.
Fan culture and fan fiction existed before the internet, but moving online shifted the nerd landscape. Now we're renegotiating who gets to be a fan and what that word even means. Mika Ellison has the story.
Hello, and welcome back to this series, where we're exploring the academic and personal effects of fanfiction. This episode, we're catching up where we left off, with a cataclysmic change in the world of fandom that would change fanfiction forever.
My name is Paul Booth. I'm a professor of media and popular culture at DePaul University. I study pop culture, but specifically, I look at the way that people use popular culture in various ways. So my research has looked at fans quite a bit.
Booth has been studying fans for almost 20 years, and in that time, they've undergone a significant publicity facelift. He has some ideas on why that might be.
I think a lot of preconceived notions were that fans were antisocial or weird in some way. Some people thought fans were violent or hypersexual or just generally very negative views of fans. And this is what in fan studies we call the kind of pejorative look at fans. That has changed hugely in the 20 years that I've been studying fans, so that now I don't think it's as odd or weird to be considered a fan. And I think a lot of fan practice is more normalized.
He has some ideas on why that might be.
Before the Marvel movies, if you had said you were a fan of Spider-Man or Iron Man or Incredible Hulk or whatever, people would have been like, oh, you're one of those people that reads comic books. But now, you know, maybe you just like the movies, maybe you like the TV shows. Our media has fragmented. So too has our fandoms. But I think the internet has also made it much more common for people to talk about their fandoms.
The internet was like the steam engine for fan culture. All the ingredients were already there in the form of fan culture. But everything moved a lot slower and was spread out over a larger area. Booth showed me a book he has from before the internet and fan culture collided. In it, you could look up the area you lived in and find a list of comic stores and other fan gathering spaces. The book isn't old by any means, but it's been rendered all but obsolete in our connected age.
The internet made it so easy and convenient to find people who like the thing you like. And I think that's why fandom has really become very specific, is because now I don't just find someone who's into this niche show I'm into, but I find people who are into this pairing, this ship pairing of these two characters in this niche show during this time period, right? Like, so you, because you can do that. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, you had to buy a book to tell you where the nearest geek store was. It's wholly different.
And that interconnectedness and the movement towards specificity changed the landscape of geekery. Samantha Close is another fan studies professor at DePaul. She edited a forthcoming book on fan video, or fan edits, which have been around in the form of male VCRs since the 80s at least, but underwent a similar transformation relatively recently.
What's happened now is that you see fan video being incredibly accessible. If you do a search for any kind of film, TV program, podcast, whatever, on YouTube or on TikTok, you're going to come up with fan videos. It's not just going to be clips of the canon. And that proximity to mainstream culture is having an impact both on the fan video itself, and the fan video is having an impact on that mainstream culture.
Now, my For You page doesn't just have sports highlights. It has fan edits for individual players, complete with their own theme songs. I'm not just getting book and movie reviews. I get fan videos of everything from The Hunger Games to Bluey. Closest point is that fandom is migrating into the mainstream via sites like TikTok and YouTube, which might have huge implications for how it works in the future and for who considers themselves a fan.
Having these sites means that the fan communities form in a bit of a different way. They're more accessible in some ways, I think, because they're, you can find them from a simple keyword search. You don't need to know someone the way that you used to need to know someone, or need to be able to get to a specific convention the way you used to had to go to a convention to get a VHS tape of the fan video, right? But it also means that they're more diffuse and they're less distinct, and it's harder for things like established norms and specific cultures to maintain.
That lack of specific agreed-upon norms, like the way individual Reddit threads are strictly monitored, does mean things can get crazy. Fandom wars aren't just small spats or individual fights anymore. They can even end up in court, like when two authors accuse the other of plagiarism when both wrote books based on a common fanfiction trope, the Omegaverse.
When people who have really intense emotions already, because that's what it takes to be a fan, get socially connected to each other, flame wars and, you know, politics are a given. So there's nothing exactly new about it. It just plays out in different ways, and it plays out at a different sense of scale, because, and it plays out in a way that's visible, in a way that it wouldn't have been in the era of zines, where you had to have known someone to get on the zine mailing list, and that zine is only going to be distributed to a few people.
Northwestern professor Jen Comerford brought up another potential con of the digital age. The original author of a work is quite visible. Authors like J.K. Rowling continue to interpret their own work online, especially on Twitter, long after it's been published.
It's another thing now, you know, in our mass media age of authors who are actively commenting and tweeting their views that kind of affect the way that we then engage with that work, because they're still out there, they still have a voice, they still haven't accepted that their death as an author.
Which leads us back to fanfiction itself. What did the internet do to change our understanding of authorship and fan works? I brought in Northwestern students Asha Mehta and Abigail Jacob for this one, to get the details on where fanfiction is on the internet, and how each site is different. It all starts somewhere, with what Close describes as the great-grandparent of all fanfiction sites.
I was a big fanfiction.net girly for a long time. Like, I wrote on that site. Fanfiction.net, to me, gives very much, like, Library of Alexandria. Like, it's old, it's ancient, but there's, like, some treasures in there.
So I grew up in the age where, like, the place for fanfiction was fanfic.net. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, that is no longer the case.
Fanfiction.net is more of a relic than an active site. The next branch on the family tree is Wattpad, which is widely used, but tends to get a bad rep.
And then I had a friend who was, like, into My Chemical Romance. And, like, it was getting to the point, like, because, you know, we, like, talk about what we like. And so she would talk about MCR fanfiction, and it was getting to the point where I was like, okay, like, I feel like I need to start reading it to understand her.
Yeah.
So that's when I hopped on Wattpad.
My evolution, I feel like, was pretty basic in that, in elementary and early middle school, I was a Wattpad user, and I would write on there, and I do not remember the login to my Wattpad account, so that stuff's all out there.
I think it's, like, where everyone, like, kind of begins. It's, like, I think also, in my opinion, it's where a lot of, like, the bad connotations of fanfiction, like, comes from. Like, I hear, at least, I don't know, maybe, like, this is just the spaces that I'm in, but, like, a lot of people make fun of, like, the Harry Styles fanfictions and stuff, like, that's all Wattpad.
And our final destination? All roads in the internet eventually lead to AO3, which is, as Maida puts it, for true connoisseurs.
And then I think in eighth grade, one of my best friends was really into Supernatural fanfic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she told me to go on AO3, and she made fun of me for using Wattpad and was like, AO3 is what the cool kids use. And I was like, okay, you know, because I was 13. I was like, sure, I'll believe anything you say. You're my best friend.
I was told by my students that it's AO3 is really the space for that. They kind of laughed at me when I did this, but I was like, okay, well, now that I know that AO3 is the place, I went on there and I saw that there are plenty of Tempest fanfictions. There are plenty of course, Pride and Prejudice fanfictions. So I put links to those, so they're welcome to, you know, bring those in.
Maida summed up the general attitude towards AO3 nicely.
I would say for me, from my perspective, if there's a spectrum of fanfiction that goes from, like, would scar you for life to genuinely the best thing you've ever read, I would say AO3 occupies both of the extreme ends of that spectrum. I feel like AO3 is where you go to, like, if you're brave enough, yeah, that's where you go to find the gems.
Mm-hmm. Like high risk, high reward.
High risk, high reward, exactly.
AO3 is kind of like the levels of the ocean. The deeper you go, the stranger it can get. Maida and Jacob told me they've encountered fanfiction based on the boat that got stuck in the Suez Canal. They've read Harry Potter fanfiction that explains a different philosophical concept within each chapter. They've even read crossover Shakespeare fanfiction. Close agrees with their assessment, for the most part, and added some history. AO3's full name is Archive of Our Own, because it's entirely fan-run and operated.
There's a lot to love about the Archive of Our Own. The fact that it was started by fans, it's a non-profit, it is for fans, is all to the good, right? Saying, okay, we need to own the servers. We need to not let this be vulnerable to another commercial platform that doesn't care about us. For instance, as Tumblr, that was the darling of fandom, proved when they were like, oh, we're going to take all adult content off of Tumblr, right? Like, but this happens again and again. If you look at the history of social media platforms, especially anything that's considered adult, can be very vulnerable. And so there's a lot to love about it in that way.
But AO3 has run into some really interesting problems. It's not censored, and the content on the site isn't necessarily monitored. While this allows for the kind of interesting creative works we just talked about, it also opens the door to content that is actively harmful, like racism.
If you say, we're not going to censor anything, then you have declared that you have no standards, and that you are willing to let people be harmed. And especially if they are not the dominant population on your platform. And what's going to happen, as some new research that I have just been reviewing has found out, is that people will leave. Fans of color are significantly less likely to use the Archive of Our Own. And I think that's sad because of all of the reasons that the Archive is great. But they have made that choice to not make themselves a safe platform for a particular community, and thus that's what's going to happen. People are going to leave.
Fanfiction as a whole has a lot of problems that are often reflected in the sites it's written on. A gender disparity favoring male characters, sites that don't work, and the dubious ethicality of writing about real people are just a few examples. But according to almost everyone I spoke to, it's here to stay. The answer isn't trying to stop fanfiction writing or sites, but instead to look at it more closely, and the way it can often mirror the real world. Asha Maida is also a creative writer. Having written several novels and short stories, fanfiction was a huge part of her journey.
I think that writing fanfiction has made me a much better writer because it allows you to sort of build up your writing stamina because you've got this world and these characters you absolutely love already feel immersed in, and you can sort of explore the concepts of character development and plot development through a framework that is pre-built. I think that was really valuable for me, especially as a younger writer. I wasn't able to create these nuanced characters like out of my own mind in the same way as I can now, because that's a skill that takes a really long time to develop. But fan fiction allowed me to write these more epic, emotionally involved stories anyways.
One of the experts I spoke to compared the way writers use characters and plots from other stories to the way budding artists often copy the work of the masters to get a sense of technique and style. Jacob agreed with Meta's take and added a memory of her own.
I wrote Percy Jackson fanfiction on there. yeah, like, I don't know what else there is really to say to that. Like, I never finished anything because I was 12 years old and I had, like, no, like, writing stamina. I remember I used to, like, it was, like, my little secret because, like, I was 12, so I didn't have a computer. So I would go on my mom's, like, work computer at night after she went to bed. And, like, I'd always, like, be so sure to, like, make sure I'm, like, closing all my tabs before I leave.
Although the times and media are very different, and fan culture has experienced some significant changes along the way, Jacob's story echoes closes from last episode. Sometimes fanfiction is just about wanting to express yourself to people who might hear you, or wanting more of something. Jacob summed it up best.
Fanfiction is both the beauty of humanity, but also everything wrong with it.
For WNUR News, I'm Mika Ellison.
Last week's pop culture events had the world talking. From fashion fails, lawsuits, and more, Jessica Watts has the tea.
Welcome to the B-List, your weekly roundup of celebrity mess and pop culture. This week, the Met Gala, Bad Bunny's new tour, and more sports playoffs. The 2025 Met Gala took place last week with many iconic looks and celebrity mess. This year's theme was super fine, tailoring black style. Diana Ross, Zendaya, Rihanna, and Teyana Taylor were just a few of the guests that had everyone talking with their incredible looks. Rihanna also debuted her fresh baby bump, announcing her pregnancy with her third child. Taylor Swift, Timothy Chalamet, and Kris Jenner are just a few of the notable guests who did not attend this year's event. In music news, Bad Bunny announced his upcoming Debí Tirar Más Fotos World Tour. The tour shockingly does not have any stops in the U.S., leaving many American fans disappointed. The Latin music star will begin his tour in November in the Dominican Republic. Thunderbolts, Sinners, and a Minecraft movie continued to chart the box office last week, earning millions of dollars globally. In other movie news, It Ends With Us is continuing to cause drama, now involving one of the world's biggest stars. It was revealed this week that Taylor Swift has been subpoenaed in the ongoing trial between Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni. Baldoni and his team are alleging Swift had something to do with the recommended script changes in the movie, part of what caused the lawsuit. The second round of the NBA playoffs began last week, leaving only 8 teams left in the East and West. The NHL playoffs are also underway, with the Winnipeg Jets and the Washington Capitals fighting to keep their top spots. That's all for the B-List this week. Check in next Monday to hear about what happens this week in pop culture. For WNUR News, I'm Jessica Watts.
Now for a brief look at the forecast. Today was gorgeous, and we have some more of that on the way. Well, kinda. Tomorrow, we will have a high of 65 and a low of 54. It will be cloudy throughout the day, with some rain showers early in the morning. Wednesday will be more of the same, but no chance of rain. Thursday, the sky will open up just a tad. The sun will be out mainly in the morning, with the rest of the day being partly cloudy. The high will be 79, and the low will be 56. It will be the hottest around 5 o'clock. Now, let's take a look into the headlines in Chicago, across the nation, and the globe. Just hours ago, a swimmer was pulled out of Lake Michigan on Chicago's south side. The male swimmer had been reported missing around 2 p.m. Around 3 p.m., Chicago Fire Department divers pulled an unresponsive man out of the water. University of Chicago Medical Center officials say he is in critical condition. Chicago beaches officially open the Friday before Memorial Day. President Trump embarked on a 4-day trip to the Middle East earlier today. He will visit Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. According to the administration, his top priority is to strengthen each country's economic relationship with the U.S. This marks the first major trip of the president's second term. Adan Alexander, the last known living American hostage in Gaza, was released today. The 21-year-old New Jersey native was serving in the Israeli Defense Force near the Gaza border when Hamas took him hostage on October 7, 2023. His release is a result of talks between the U.S. and Hamas that left out Israel. That's all for WNUR News at 6. For more news, updates, and reports, follow us on X @WNUR News and on Instagram @WNUR News 89.3. You can listen to these and other WNUR News stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Mika Ellison, and our reporters are Sophia Kesa, Darcimi Biancali, and Mika Ellison. I'm Naya Reyes. Catch our next newscast on Wednesday, May 14th. Now, back to scheduled programming.